The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, we're reading from the edition dated October 28th, 2011. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Our first item this week from the main stories section of The Week magazine is entitled, Israel Trades 1,000 Prisoners for One Soldier. What happened? In an Egyptian brokered deal that is causing both joy and anger, Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was freed this past week in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. Shalit, kidnapped by Hamas near the Gaza border more than 5 years ago, was denied Red Cross visits throughout his imprisonment, and his gaunt, pale appearance in an interview on Egyptian television outraged Israeli viewers. For their part, Hamas officials said the first 477 prisoners released this week, many of them serving life sentences for killing Israelis, had been subjected to torture, compulsion, and revenge. Among those released to win Shalit's freedom were Palestinians who participated in numerous bombings that killed scores of Israelis, including attacks on a Jerusalem pizza restaurant filled with families, a Tel Aviv nightclub, and a bus in Haifa. Several Palestinians who had stabbed Israeli teenagers to death were also released. Family members of those killed bitterly opposed the prisoner exchange, calling it a day of mourning. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it was the best deal he could get, and that it was his duty as Israel's leader to bring home every soldier who is sent to protect our citizens. Now here's what the editorial said. Netanyahu twisted himself in an ideological knot to get this deal, said the New York Times. He has long insisted that Israel should not negotiate with terrorists. Yet now he has handed sworn killers back to the very terrorist group that shoots rockets at Israel and is pledged to the country's destruction. By forcing this deal on Israel, Netanyahu has made it clear that he could also halt settlement building and start real peace negotiations with the Palestinians if he wanted to. The problem is not that he can't compromise and make tough choices, it's that he won't. What is Netanyahu's thinking, asked the New York Post, releasing 1,000 hardened terrorists into a region that is already overflowing with them is hardly conducive to peace. These criminals will have ready access to the heat-seeking missiles and other sophisticated weapons that are even now being funneled into Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula from Libya as the war there winds down. It's not at all clear that this bargain is in Israel's best interests. You have to admire Israel's willingness to pay an exorbitant price for its citizens, said the Wall Street Journal. That sacrifice stands as a testament to its national and religious values. But the Shalit deal makes more kidnappings of Israelis inevitable. Indeed, Hamas has already pledged to take more Israeli hostages to trade for the remaining 5,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails. Now here's what the commentators said. Israel simply had no choice but to trade for Shalit, said Nahum Barnea in the Tel Aviv Yedoth Ahronoth. The price is excessive, the risks are great, and the precedent is displeasing. But Israel has a national, even biblical, obligation to protect its citizens and especially its soldiers. Shalit was a 19-year-old recruit defending his country when he was snatched and his two companions were murdered. To let him die in captivity is unacceptable. It does not meet the minimum conditions of the Israeli tribe. But Israel had crasser motives as well, said Sefi Raklevsky in the Tel Aviv publication Haaretz. Netanyahu could have struck this exact deal with Hamas the day after Shalit was abducted. Hamas's demands were the same then. So why now? Part of the reason was to undermine Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Fatah faction that is Hamas's rival. Abbas has been enjoying popularity among Palestinians for his high-profile appeal for statehood in the UN. This deal weakens him and strengthens Hamas, leaving the Palestinians even more divided. Ultimately, though, the deal changes almost nothing, said Aaron David Miller in foreignpolicy.com. Had the deal included the most famous Palestinian prisoner, former Fatah leader Marwan Barghouti, that would have been a direct challenge and threat to Abbas's leadership. But Barghouti remains in jail, and the fact that Hamas and Israel managed to strike one limited prisoner swap doesn't augur some new era of peace. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict drags on with little prospect of serious negotiations, let alone a conflict-ending accord. Our next item from the main story section of the Week magazine, a heated GOP debate. The race for the Republican presidential nomination turned nasty this past week as seven nominees took turns attacking each other at the latest GOP debate. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney bore the brunt of the assaults, a reflection of his status as the frontrunner. Texas Governor Rick Perry, who has slumped badly in the polls, took a much more aggressive stance, reviving a 2008 charge that Romney lied about employing illegal immigrants to work at his home. "You stood here in front of the American people and did not tell the truth," Perry said. The accusation provoked an exchange of angry words and finger-pointing, with Perry interrupting Romney several times. "If you want to become president of the United States, you got to let both people speak," said Romney. Former pizza executive Herman Cain, who has surged in the polls, was forced to play defense as rival candidates repeatedly criticized his 999 tax plan. "Move over, Jerry Springer," said Chris Steirwalt in FoxNews.com. "This debate had all the anger, betrayals, and savage attacks of a trashy daytime talk show. Even Romney lost the cool, attractive countenance that has won him every debate so far." His claim that the main reason he couldn't have illegals working for him was because he was running for office, for Pete's sake, will not impress conservatives one bit. Rick Perry's belligerence was excessive at times, but will help him, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "He seemed dead in the water after the last debate, but has snarled his way back into the conversation. But even naked aggression couldn't make up for the old confusion and inability to articulate that have plagued Perry throughout the debates." Romney and Perry's bitter bickering set the tone for the race ahead, said Michael Shear in the New York Times. "Their palpable animosity matches that of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in 2008, when the two candidates, fueled by prodigious fundraising, battled to the end of the primaries. Perry and Romney each can raise cash, so we could be in for another nasty, brutish, and potentially long fight for the nomination." And the next item from the main story section, Obama amends health plan. The Obama administration dropped long-term care insurance from its health care reform law last week after finding that it cost too much. The program, known as Community Living Assistance Services and Support, would have given workers the option of paying an affordable monthly premium to collect a daily cash benefit if they become disabled later in life. But a 19-month government review determined that the program would have lost money, so it had to be scrapped. "We have not identified a way to make CLASS work," said Health Secretary Catherine Sebelius, who added that the move does not affect the rest of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell said CLASS was just one part of an unwise, unsustainable law that should be repealed in full. And CLASS, by the way, means, just as a reminder, the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Program. This aborted plan illustrates the recklessness that produced the Affordable Care Act, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The president's claim that his health reforms would save us money has now been proved patently false. If Obamacare as a whole were subjected to a similar financial audit, it would collapse in a heartbeat. Class had a fatal design flaw, said Jonathan Cohn in the New Republic. It was voluntary, so only the old and sick would have enrolled. Without premiums from younger people, it was doomed to go bust. The rest of the Affordable Care Act is financially stable because it makes health insurance compulsory. But Republicans attack Obama's reforms no matter what he does. They should just admit that they don't think it's worthwhile to make sure everybody can pay their medical bills. Bickering won't fix our utterly failed system, said Howard Gleckman in Forbes.com. 20 million people will need long-term care in the next few decades, but half of Americans have less than $55,000 in financial assets, barely enough to cover 9 months in a nursing home. Once a patient's money runs out, cash-strapped Medicaid must step in. To prevent financial disaster, our leaders must stop squabbling and work out a consensus plan. Now let's turn to the controversy of the week in the Week magazine. Romney, the GOP's inevitable nominee? From the point of view of a Republican primary voter, Mitt Romney would seem to have it all, said Jonathan Martin in Politico.com. He's intelligent, articulate, handsome, experienced in both business and government, and the candidate with the best shot of winning over independents and beating Barack Obama in next year's presidential election. Yet most Republicans still don't want to nominate him. For months now, polls show Romney's support among Republican voters stuck just short of 25%, while the party keeps casting about for more conservative alternatives, from Michelle Bachmann to Rick Perry to Herman Cain. The so-called Republican establishment may have accepted Romney as the inevitable nominee, said Ed Kilgore in NewRepublic.com, but those in the fired-up Tea Party base haven't. They don't consider Romney a true conservative because as governor of Blue State, Massachusetts, he pushed through a universal health care plan that served as the basis for Obamacare and was for gay rights and legal abortion before he was against them. So now it's gut check time for the right. Does the GOP nominate the safe bet, or will party leaders just throw up their hands and let the rank and file roll the dice on a hard right candidate like Perry or Cain? This much is clear, said Mark Sappenfield in CSMonitor.com. Mitt Romney is clearly not what his own party wants. With the economic misery index still sky high, President Obama looks extremely vulnerable, and that has the Tea Party conservative base in no mood to compromise. Conservatives don't want to lose another election by picking an unexciting moderate like Bob Dole or John McCain, or almost as bad, wind up with a centrist Republican president like George H.W. Bush. They want a revolution, and Romney simply isn't the man to provide it. He may currently have the appearance of being the frontrunner, said Rick Moran in AmericanThinker.com, but that's because at the moment the conservative vote is badly split among Cain, Perry, and Bachmann. As the field narrows and the conservatives rally behind a single not-Mitt candidate, we'll see how inevitable he is. It's already too late, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. GOP voters may be yearning for an ideologically pure nominee, but the fact that Romney is still leading the pack proves that they've failed to find one. Bachmann and Perry briefly surged in the polls before showing they were not ready for prime time. The Cain boomlet is about over, too. Romney may not inspire passion, said Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal, but Republicans are slowly coming around to him based on his strong, confident debate performances. In polls, 60% of self-described very conservative Republicans say they have positive feelings about Romney. Even those who support other candidates name Romney as their second choice. If the question is whether Republicans can learn to live with Romney, the numbers suggest many already have. Such lukewarm support hardly guarantees success in the upcoming primaries, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Romney is still Romney, cool, smooth, even robotic at times, and doesn't inspire or connect with conservatives hungry for real leadership. Given the GOP's desperation for a candidate who can beat Obama, it's possible that Romney's lack of genuine conservative fire won't cost him the nomination. But it helps account for the tenuous attachment of voters to him that still makes him vulnerable, even as the talk of his inevitability grows. And now from The Week magazine, we turn to the popular column entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for getting the most out of your one phone call. After the release of an Android app called I'm Getting Arrested, which lets users press a single icon to notify friends and family that they're being hauled off to jail. Hard to read that one with a straight face. It was a good week for vengeance after Florida State Representative Brad Drake proposed that the state's execution be conducted by electrocution and firing squad instead of lethal injection. Drake said that killers should know they will die violently rather than by going to sleep. And it was a good week for holding it in after Evergreen Park High School in Illinois announced that students would be allowed to leave class to go to the bathroom only three times per semester. Students who need to urinate more often will have to make up class time after school. And it was a bad week for sportsmanship after Cholapat Itiari of Thailand accused his opponent at the World Scrabble Championship of hiding a missing G tile and demanded that he be strip searched. Officials denied the demand and his opponent won the game by 1 point. It was a bad week for tradition after Ireland ended the 350-year-old practice of requiring judges to wear British-style white wigs in court. The decision will save the cash-strapped government about $3,000 a wig. And it was a bad week for getting lost on purpose after a family in Danvers, Massachusetts, had to call 911 when they couldn't find their way out of a 7-acre corn maze. "I'm really scared. It's really dark, and we've got a 3-week-old baby with us," said the mom who made the call. "We thought this would be fun." And that's a good week for and bad week for this week. Now we'll turn to the People section of The Week magazine. Our first item is Jackman's Second Chance. Hugh Jackman was born to sing and dance, said Ryan Gilbey in the London Guardian. The burly Australian actor, best known for playing the clawed superhero Wolverine in the X-Men series, fell in love with musical theater at the age of 5 after starring in a school performance of Camelot. At 10 years old, he asked his father if he could take dance lessons. His father approved. His older brother didn't. "What are you, a poof?" Jackman recalls him saying, "I wasn't 100% sure what that was, but I knew it didn't sound like something I should be, and that was it as far as dance. I shut it down." His brother apologized when Jackman was 18. "That released something for me. I signed up for a tap dance class the day after. It was too late for a dancing career, but that hasn't stopped him from hitting the boards as a triple threat performer. Jackman has starred in several Broadway musicals and recently brought a one-man song and dance show to the stage. He even had to be discouraged from giving Wolverine jazz hands. Director Bryan Singer used to yell at me, 'Stop moving, just stand there and say your lines.' His ebullient showmanship has led to questions about his sexuality, but Jackman, who's been married for 15 years, laughs off the suggestion that he's gay. 'You really know you've made it when the gay rumor starts,' he says. The next item is called A Century of War Reporting. At the age of 100, Claire Hollingworth longs to be back on the battlefield, said Neil Tweedy in the London Telegraph. As the Telegraph's war correspondent, she covered almost every major conflict of the mid-20th century, filing stories from the deserts of North Africa during World War II and the jungles of Vietnam in the 1960s. Hollingsworth's first scoop came while on assignment in Poland in August 1939. Returning from a trip into Germany to buy supplies, she noticed that large fabric screens had been erected alongside the roadside. Suddenly, a great gust of wind blew the sacking from its moorings, she recalls. I looked into the valley and saw scores, if not hundreds, of tanks. Hollingworth had stumbled on the opening gambit of World War II. 3 days later, the panzers rolled into Poland. She spent the rest of the war dashing around Africa and Europe. I must admit I enjoy being in a war, she says. I'm not brave, I just enjoy it. She still keeps her passport handy, just in case. If she were younger, she says, I should look through the papers and say, where's the most dangerous place to go? Because it always makes a good story. And the next item in the People section, Minai's Fantasy World. Nicki Minaj had a hard-knock childhood, said Shirley Halperin in Cosmopolitan. At age 4, she left her native Trinidad and moved with her parents to a gritty neighborhood in Queens, New York. On the corner of the block was where the drug dealers would hang out, says the hip-hop star. Her father became a regular customer and was soon hooked on crack. My mother left him many different times and came back, says Minaj, who is 28 years old now. He would beg, cry, stalk us. One time he pulled my mother out of a car and dragged her for 2 blocks. After that, I had a phobia about unlocked doors. During another fight, he set fire to their house. He was attempting to kill my mother. She got out before it burned all the way down. To cope with the chaos, Minaj started dreaming of an over-the-top life and began to create the Technicolor personality that has propelled her to stardom. I would pray to God to make me famous so I could buy my mother a huge house. I'd tell her, let's go to a ballroom like Cinderella, she says. She would laugh at me, but I knew I wasn't put here to be a regular person. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the briefing section. This week the title is The Death Penalty in Decline. The number of countries that execute criminals is dropping. Is capital punishment on the way out? How many countries have the death penalty? Capital punishment laws are on the books in 91 countries, but only 23 of them carried out any executions last year. The United States executed 46 people last year and 37 so far this year. More than any other country except for the dictatorships of China, North Korea, Iran, and Yemen. In most parts of the modern world, the practice appears to be in steep decline. Since 1976, a total of 123 countries have effectively abolished the death penalty as a barbaric legacy of the past. All signs point to an unmistakable downward trend, says Mario Mazziti, a co-founder of the World Coalition Against the Death Penalty. There is worldwide growth of a new moral standard of decency and of respect for human rights, he said, even the rights and lives of those who have committed severe crimes. Is that trend likely to extend to the United States? It already has in parts of the country. Illinois scrapped the death penalty in March of this year, and New Jersey did so in 2007. Lawmakers in California, Connecticut, Florida, Ohio, and Maryland introduced legislation this year to abolish the death penalty in those states. A recent Gallup poll found that the U.S. public's approval of the death penalty had dropped by 19 percentage points over the past 17 years and currently stands at 61%, the lowest level since 1972. And although 34 states retain capital punishment laws, only 11 states executed prisoners last year, down from 20 in 1999. In effect, the death penalty has become a regional practice. Texas, Oklahoma, and Virginia alone account for more than half of U.S. executions. Why does the U.S. remain an outlier? A majority of Americans continue to believe that capital punishment is the only way to deliver proportional justice to a murderer. Someone who murders another human being can only be made to pay for his actions by forfeiting his own life, says death penalty advocate Casey Carmichael. If the punishment for theft is imprisonment, then the punishment for murder must be exponentially more severe, because human life is infinitely more valuable than any material item. This view is largely rooted in the Bible and its eye-for-an-eye ethos, which still exerts a powerful influence in parts of the U.S. where religious conservatives predominate. Abolition has taken its firmest hold in post-Christian Europe and has least support in the church-going United States, conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has written. I attribute that to the fact that, for the believing Christian, death is no big deal. Intentionally killing an innocent person is a big deal. Then why is support declining? Mostly because DNA testing has revealed numerous cases of people sentenced to death for crimes they did not commit. At least 138 people on death row have been exonerated since 1973, and four convicts, three in Texas and one in Missouri, have had their innocence proven only after they were put to death. Last month, Georgia executed a man named Troy Davis, despite serious questions about the evidence in his murder case. The possibility that the government may mistakenly kill the innocent has changed the minds of many former death penalty supporters. So have statistics showing that a convicted murderer is far more likely to be executed if he kills a white person rather than a black person. The high cost of capital punishment has also eaten away at support. What do executions cost? Executions themselves aren't expensive. The lethal injection used by Texas reportedly costs $86 a shot, but the cost of the many protracted legal battles that precede an execution weighs on state budgets. Every death penalty sentence goes through multiple appeals and can take more than a decade to carry out. Each of the 13 executions California has carried out since 1978, a recent study found, cost taxpayers $308 million. Partly for that reason, a poll found this year that for the first time, California voters favored life imprisonment without the possibility of parole over the death penalty. Will the U.S. abolish the death penalty? Current trends suggest that the number of states that execute prisoners will continue to dwindle. But with capital punishment still popular with voters, it is unlikely to disappear altogether unless the Supreme Court rules that it is cruel and unusual punishment. Given the conservative makeup of the current Supreme Court, that is not likely for the foreseeable future. But even the current Supreme Court is demonstrating growing queasiness about the government's power to kill. The court ruled in 2002 that the Constitution forbids the execution of the mentally retarded. 3 years later, it extended the protection to prisoners younger than 18. The mounting evidence that capital punishment is imposed arbitrarily and sometimes on the innocent will eat away at the court's toleration of execution, says University of California law professor Franklin Zimring. The end game in the effort to purge the United States of the death penalty has already been launched. And a footnote to this briefing article about the death penalty, a warden's change of heart. Three times in his 22-year career in Florida's corrections system, Warden Ron McAndrew presided over an execution in the electric chair. Each time his private doubts grew. During the third execution he witnessed, the condemned prisoner's head burst into flames, and McAndrew had to give the order to continue. This is wrong, he decided. McAndrew, now a prison consultant, joined a small group of ex-wardens turned death penalty abolitionists including Gene Woodford of San Quentin in California and Donald Cabana of Parchman Penitentiary in Mississippi. These wardens say that participating in the planned, cold-blooded killing of human beings has haunted them, and that it inflicts lasting trauma on corrections officers. Many colleagues turned to drugs and alcohol from the pain of knowing a man died at their hands, McAndrew said. The state dishonors us by putting us in this situation. This is premeditated, carefully thought out, ceremonial killing. He advocates an alternative that doesn't lower us to the level of the killer, permanent imprisonment. And now from the Week magazine, let's take a look at the best columns in the U.S. this past week, according to the Week. The first one is entitled, Will Hillary Switch to Vice President?, written by Jonathan Alter in Bloomberg.com. Will Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden switch jobs? Asked Jonathan Alter. Don't rule it out. Rumors of a great switcheroo involving the Secretary of State and Vice President have been denied by the Obama administration, but those denials will be moot if it's clear that Democrats need to do something dramatic to avoid losing the White House. Putting the very popular Hillary on the ticket as vice president would serve several purposes. She would ensure that Obama benefited from a large gender gap and would help build support among blue-collar independents. With Bill Clinton taking a visible role alongside his wife, Obama would be able to cast the election as a choice between the Clintonian economics of the 1990s and the Bush GOP economics that led to the Great Recession. The switch would also excite Democrats at a sour and dispiriting time. It all may seem far-fetched now, but if Obama's approval rating doesn't improve by summer and the unemployment numbers remain bleak, then the switcheroo may be his only shot. The next column is entitled, No Spring for Egypt's Christians, by Ross Dutat in the New York Times. The Copts of Egypt, the Coptics that is, are one of the oldest Christian communities in the world, dating to the 1st century A.D., said Ross Dutat. They've survived the fall of Rome, the rise of Islam, and innumerable rulers, but they may not survive the Arab Spring. Since a popular uprising toppled Egypt's government, the 8 million Coptic Christians have faced increased persecution and mob violence, and 100,000 Copts have already fled the country. Two dozen Copts were killed last week in clashes with the Egyptian army. Sadly, this is a familiar story for Christians throughout the Arab world. When tyrants fall and democracy movements take root, religious and ethnic minorities are invariably prosecuted. The same phenomenon happened in Europe during the 20th century when multi-ethnic empires were cut up into homogeneous nation-states through war, genocide, and redrawing of national borders. Obviously, a democratic Middle East would be a remarkable triumph for humanity. But in more democratic and more overtly Islamic nations, Christians and other minorities may be driven out. Is it worth it? Maybe we should ask the Coptics. And the next column is entitled America, the Chosen Nation by Andrew Bosovich in the Los Angeles Times. Are Americans the new chosen people? Asked Andrew Bosovich. For anyone running for president, the belief that God has chosen us to lead the world has become a prerequisite. Republican hopeful Mitt Romney recently became the latest contender to affirm his loyalty to American exceptionalism, insisting last week, America must lead the world, and I will never, ever apologize for America. On what do politicians base their claims about America's divine role? Not the Hebrew Bible and not the teachings of Jesus Christ. Instead, it appears to be part of some de facto third testament in which our military supremacy serves God's purposes. When we launch botched and bloody wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's because we're promoting freedom and unselfishly serving mankind. Therefore, we must be exempt from rules governing lesser nations. Next year, Republicans will argue that Obama doesn't believe in America's divine mission. And as he's done before, Obama will reaffirm that he, too, believes in the Third Testament. So no matter who triumphs in 2012, the real winner is going to be the concept of American exceptionalism. ¶¶ And now from the Week magazine, we will flip to the back of the magazine to the section entitled The Last Word. And the title for The Last Word this week is Rin Tin Tin Reborn. He was the world's most famous dog, says Susan Orlean, but his star had faded until the baby boom arrived. In the fall of 1954, the American television schedule included puppets and comics, average families and aging celebrities, cowboys, detectives, and two dogs with Hollywood histories. Lassie was gentle and pastoral in tone, more domesticated than the adventures of Rin Tin Tin, which often included shooting, knifing, punching, war, arrow shooting, Indian attacks, scuffles, gun butting, but no sword play, strangling, torture, or flogging, according to the Motion Picture Association of America's analysis. In fact, the adventures of Rin Tin Tin was considered rough enough that censors in Britain removed certain scenes, especially ones that showed Rinty fighting, and Germany banned the show from playing on religious holidays. Some of the early episodes were almost comically violent, a matter that shows aggressive young producer Burt Leonard and Screen Gems squabbled over during the production. In one such squabble, Burt conceded several points to the studio. The action kill of the mountain lion will be done off scene, and the savageness of the situation will be held down. We will get enough of it to make it exciting, but definitely not gruesome. The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin was broadcast for the first time on October 15, 1954. The debut episode told the story of how the fighting Blue Devils of the 101st Cavalry came to be stewards of the young Rusty and his dog Rinty, or as Sergeant O'Hara of the 101st put it, how we found them two little orphans. Only after I had learned the personal history of Rinty's trainer, Lee Duncan, did I realize how this story recalled his own time as an orphan, and also the orphaned French boy who had lived with Lee's squadron during World War I, the little chum who had served as the squadron's mascot until French authorities took him away. It was Lee who had found the puppy he later named Rin Tin Tin, on September 15, 1918, in a German encampment, and it was Lee who raised and trained him and his progeny and made them into movie stars a generation ago. Burt and Lee were confident that Rin Tin Tin would triumph again, but even so, the reception of the Adventures of Rin Tin Tin received must have been overwhelming. The show was an instant success by every measure. It had one of the fastest ratings climbs in television history, and from its start was ABC's second highest rated show overall, trailing only The Walt Disney Show. 9 million of the 30 million televisions in the United States were tuned in, several million more than were tuned to Lassie, which had premiered on CBS a month earlier. It was also a critical success, crammed with action, gunplay, and chase scenes of pre-musical cowpoke westerns, wrote a critic in TV Guide. It makes fine viewing for kids and nostalgic viewing for grown-ups. Lee and Rin Tin Tin were once again the center of the nation's attention. How many years had passed since Rinty's great movies of the 1920s and 30s, and yet here they were as if the dog were fresh, a fresh new discovery. The show was broadcasting in 70 other countries besides the United States. Just as in earlier decades, Rin Tin Tin was everywhere. He was a single point connecting people all over the world, from all different cultures and circumstances, all of them watching as the camera angled up to the crest of a hill where a big dog stood at alert, a depthless silhouette against a western sky in a placeless place somewhere in timeless history of America. At Corriganville Movie Ranch, where the series was shot, the cast and crew worked 6 days out of seven, racing to shoot two episodes a week. They shot 30 or 40 scenes every day. The schedule was so intense that none of the actors had time to launder their costumes. There was a flood of requests from schools and civic groups, hospitals, rodeos. Everyone wanted a visit from Rinty or from anyone connected to the show. Screen Gems, delighted and also besieged, hired a public relations executive named Wahalu LaHaye to manage the enthusiasm. LaHaye crafted a marvelously fictitious biography for Ren 10 10 that circulated to the press. One more addition to the many versions of his life that had been concocted over the years. In LaHaye's account, Rinty's mother was a German police dog from Buffalo that had been recruited for the Army Expeditionary Forces by Flight Commander William Thaw of the 135th Aero Squadron. According to LaHaye's account, Lee somehow found Rinty in the hospital and kidnapped him. Later, the puppy accompanied Lee on his many fictional combat flights. Rinty, as LaHaye explained, lived in sybaritic luxury. His valet curried him every morning with a butter-soft rubber brush and bathed him with every afternoon in a porcelain tub. He lived in a miniature stucco palace with electric lights, plumbing, a sterling silver food trough, a radio that was always tuned to classical music, and a large mailbox which was bursting with 10,000 fan letters a week. The part about the fan letters was true. Lee himself got hundreds of letters from dog owners for whom he had become a sort of paradigm, the perfect dog owner of the perfect dog. By 1954, more than 40% of American households included at least one dog. Mixed breeds were the most common, and the most popular purebreds were beagles, boxers, cocker spaniels, and dachshunds. German shepherds and collies, the two breeds now in prime time, were the fifth and sixth most popular breeds. Just as he had in the 1920s and 30s with old Wren, and then again in the 1940s with Wren 10-10-3, Lee stood out as the person who could serve as an intermediary between people and this nation of dogs. Many people said they remembered Ren 10-10 from the period when the dog had appeared in air-conditioned movie palaces in the downtowns of the big cities, the old crumbling city centers, which were now being abandoned for the suburbs. Ren 10-10 marked the turn of time for the world they knew then, which by 1954 had begun to fade, as the baby boomers arrived in numbers to fill suburban homes. With the show's success, El Rancho Ren 10-10, Lee's modest home in Riverside, California, became a destination, a place where you could see in real life the miracle dog of television. Lee had always kept old Ren to himself, but now he welcomed visitors to the ranch and encouraged them to play with Renty. He always brought them to the memory room, urging them to sit a while so he could unfurl his stories of the past. The fact that this dog, Ren 10-10-4, wasn't the dog that actually appeared on television didn't make Lee uncomfortable. Renty 4 had failed the audition and been replaced by better-trained showbiz dogs. If he worried, he wouldn't have welcomed visitors who might point out the disparity. For one thing, the various dogs used on the show looked enough alike and enough like his Renty that it would take close examination to tell them apart. But anyone could figure out that Renty lived in Riverside while the show was being filmed 60 miles away, making it obvious that the dog at El Rancho Ren 10-10 couldn't also be on the set. But no one complained. With the show's success, Lee and his wife Eva finally had some money, and Lee built the house he had been promising Eva since they moved to Riverside. A local architect designed a long structure with an elegant entrance, big jalousy windows, and the first kidney-shaped swimming pool in Riverside. It wasn't ostentatious the way a Hollywood house could be, but by Riverside standards, it was a showplace. Bert also moved into a new house, the Big Tudor on Los Feliz, with a swimming pool and a tennis court just a block from Griffith Park. Bert was only 33 years old, but the success of The Adventures of Ren 10-10 gave him new stature in Hollywood. He had never lacked for self-confidence, but now he could afford to indulge himself a little. He liked to take meetings in a bathrobe, clenching the fattest cigar he could find between his teeth. He was an avid tennis player and could hold his own on his backyard court, even though he liked to smoke those fat cigars while he played. Ren 10-10 was lucky to be reborn in the middle of the biggest baby boom in history. It began in 1946, when veterans came home from the war and got married. 77 million babies were born in the United States between 1946 and 1964. My family was a typical product of that period. My father was in the service in World War II, where he had served in Army intelligence, and then he returned home to Cleveland, his hometown. In our suburban neighborhood, every house seemed to have at least two or three kids, and the new elementary schools popped up like mushrooms. It was like living in a children's village. There were more of us than adults. After dinner, on most nights, all the children on my street came out to play for one last hour before bedtime. We poured out of our houses in our pajamas. And in that shimmery time, just after sundown, we rode our bikes up and down the sidewalk, caught fireflies, traded baseball cards, lit punks, and ran zigzagging across lawns with sparklers, leaving glittering trails in the fading light. Then we went home and watched TV. The babies of the boom consumed entertainment rapaciously, gobbling up movies and comic books and toys as well as TV. Almost as soon as The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin was on the air, you could buy a Rin Tin Tin cavalry mess kit, uniform, hat, bugle, gun, and holster, as well as a recording of the 101st Cavalry's bugle calls. Cavalry belt and suspender sets, a Ren 1010 branded pocket knife, a telescope, a walkie-talkie, a beanie, a pennant, a 3D color viewer with viewer cards, and all sorts of mechanical games. Companies' fortunes were made on licensed Ren 1010 products. These toys were pre-sold to 13,750,000 kids in a once-in-a-blue-moon opportunity, according to an ad in Merchandising News magazine. The effect of all these children, the mass of us, must have been bewildering to our parents, almost like witnessing an invasion of hungry aliens, and intriguing to sociologists and marketers. Children, and especially teenagers, had never been observed and measured and considered as a group before, but now sheer numbers made them a moving force. Beginning with the baby boom, anything manufactured or produced was evaluated for its potential to appeal to all these eager children. Not only did they rescue a once famous movie dog from obscurity, but they seemed to dictate everything that their families, including their parents, watched and ate and bought. A 1955 issue of TV Guide summed things up with a story titled, "Who's Boss of Your TV Set?" The answer, according to the social scientists, was the kids. And that article was from Ren 1010, The Life and the Legend, a new book by Susan Orlean, copyrighted this year, 2011, and reprinted by permission of Simon & Schuster. Now we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled, The 99% Movement. Will it matter? Occupy Wall Street continues to gather momentum, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, with satellite protests in more than 60 American cities. Yet, as the growing protest enters its second month, critics are still asking what it's all about. The answer is simple. Income inequality. The wealthiest 400 people in the U.S. are now worth more than the bottom 150 million Americans. 3 years after taxpayers bailed out the Wall Street gamblers, whose recklessness plunged the country into the Great Recession, the average pay in the securities industry is $361,000. And the gap between the rich and everyone else is wider than ever. And the rich continue to rig the game, using their wealth to buy off politicians and lobby for laws and tax policies that help them at the expense of everyone else. No wonder, as Al Gore aptly put it, we're now seeing a primal scream of democracy. Democrats now have a unique opportunity to get behind this simple demand for economic justice, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Republicans who leap to the defense of Wall Street at any opportunity are trapped on the wrong side of the issue. Occupy Wall Street is the right cause at the right moment, and the Obama administration had better get on board. Not if Obama wants to get reelected, said Charles Gasparino in the New York Post. I have spent some time with the protesters in Zuccotti Park, the movement's headquarters in the heart of Manhattan, and I can tell you that most of the protesters are demanding a socialist revolution. Holding flags bearing Che Guevara's iconic face, these would-be revolutionaries call each other comrade and hand out pamphlets advocating Marxism as a cure-all for the inequalities of the American economic system. If the Democrats do embrace Occupy Wall Street, said Douglas Schoen in the Wall Street Journal, it may cost them the 2012 election. When the party backed the anti-war crowd in 1972, Republicans won 4 out of the next 5 presidential elections. Democrats ought to be wooing independent and moderate voters, not radical leftists who are dangerously out of touch with the broad mass of American people. I have to agree, even though the protesters have legitimate grievances, said Ann Applebaum in Slate.com. Despite the nonstop demands for democracy, the protesters are in love with their freedom of speech, but bored with democracy itself. Democracy is necessarily an unglamorous, time-consuming process, which you can turn to your advantage only by immersing yourself in rules, laws, institutions, and elections. It's certainly not as fun as camping out on Wall Street or chanting incendiary slogans. By creating a globalized movement that refuses to engage with existing democratic institutions, Occupy Wall Street is effectively ruling out the possibility of changing anything at all. Don't be so sure, said Brian Monopoly in CBSNews.com. Polls show that the 99% movement is resonating with millions of people not present at the protests, the belief that wealthy Americans have grown too rich while the majority have been left behind is shared by Americans across the political spectrum, whether rich, poor, Republican, or Democrat. If you tune out the anti-capitalist claptrap of the usual left fringe groups, said Will Marshall in NewRepublic.com, you'll hear the plaintive cry of a middle class in distress. Who isn't angry that Washington bailed out the big banks, which immediately went back to awarding their executives obscene bonuses while failing to rescue the millions of middle class Americans who lost their jobs and their savings? That bipartisan dereliction of duty is what unites the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. That's why all politicians should heed the ongoing cry of distress, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. On the 99% website, the stories that inspire the movement are a stark, pointillist portrayal of the grinding misery of the Great Recession. A construction worker laid off from his job, now doing menial labor for $12 an hour. Hard-pressed single moms who can't afford health care. The Harvard graduate who owes $60,000 and can't find a job. This is a moment that calls for bold political leadership and genuine economic reforms. But Obama's only misbegotten contribution has been a costly, ineffective health care law. And the Republican candidates don't even seem to be aware of the troubles of workers down the income scale. This movement isn't about the puerile ideology of people waving Che flags. It's about the downward mobility of middle-class Americans and the failure of politicians to stop their free fall. The next item, 999, how Keynes' tax plan would work. Herman Keynes' 999 tax plan has only one thing going for it. It's very simple, said John Schoen in MSNBC.com. If elected, the Republican presidential candidate has vowed to scrap the entire federal tax code in favor of a 9% tax on individual and corporate income, along with a 9% national sales tax. Kane claims that most people will pay less under his scheme, but virtually every economist who has studied 999 has concluded that it would cut the taxes of the rich while raising the tax bills of most working families. By almost any measure, said Timothy Egan in NewYorkTimes.com, Kane's plan is nuts, nuts, nuts. Not only would it effectively double the taxes paid by 47% of households with incomes too low to pay federal income tax, but it would impose a 9% national sales tax on everything and every service you buy on top of any local or state sales tax. So Keynes' 999 plan is not perfect, said Larry Kudrow in NationalReview.com. Like many conservatives, I worry that the European-style sales tax could start low and then be raised in the future. But overall, 999 is a vast improvement on the current tax code. Slashing the top tax rate for individuals and businesses from 35% to 9% would supply an incredibly strong economy-wide growth incentive. Liberated from these crippling taxes, companies would create up to 6 million new jobs, Kane argues, and lift wages by 10%. Many Republican voters believe that 999 would be fairer than the present tax code, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. They don't like the fact that almost half of Americans avoid paying income tax by carefully exploiting the deductions, credits, and exemptions built into the system. Under 999, no one can get a lawyer to weasel them out a better deal. And now a few short items as we reach the conclusion of our program today. A British man has become the first 100-year-old to complete a marathon. Faya Singh, who was born in India, took up his running at age 89 after his wife and child died. He finished the 26.2-mile race in Toronto this week in 8 hours and 11 minutes. No president in modern times has been reelected with a consumer confidence index below 75. Today it's at 57.5, which is 7 points lower than when Jimmy Carter lost his reelection bid. And a 20-year-old with HIV who is treated with the current antiretroviral drug regimen can now expect to live 46 more years, according to a new British study. The price of a compact fluorescent light bulb has soared 37% this year, mostly because China has temporarily shut down its rare earth industry to deal with pollution problems. Beginning January 1, the U.S. will phase in compact fluorescent bulbs as an energy-efficient but initially more costly alternative to the traditional light bulbs. Our poll watch for this week, 54% of Americans say they have a positive view of the Occupy Wall Street movement, while 23% have a negative view. Just 27% have a positive view of the Tea Party, while 65% say that that movement has had a negative impact on politics. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.